Okay, what I want to talk about today is about the impact of the First World War on the suffragette movement, on the movement. It's not just the suffragette movement, it was actually much wider, the movement for women's suffrage, than just the organisation that was called the Suffragettes. But I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about the impact slightly more generally on women and on political organisation, because I want to start with what happened before the First World War. And of course, the movement for women's vote really took off about 10 years before the First World War. And it's an incredible thing now when you think about it, when we have all this talk about people who claim that the First World War was a war for democracy and all this kind of thing. But actually, not only did not a single woman anywhere in Britain have the vote up until 1918, and we'll come on to the limitations of that even in 1918, not a single woman had the vote. Something like 40% of men didn't have the vote either. Voting was tied to property qualifications, to residency, to things like this, and therefore large sections of the working class in particular, and the poor in particular, didn't have the vote. Not only that, the government which took us into the First World War was a liberal government, a government which has supposedly had more progressive attitudes about a whole range of issues than the Tories, who were the other main party at the time. This was before Labour had become the second major party. And the Liberal Party was absolutely hostile to votes for women. Absolutely hostile. People, as you may know, it's very, very famous, the whole the sort of popular history of the suffragettes, that they chained themselves to railings, that one, Emily Wilding Davison, was killed as she tried to stop the King's horse at the Epsom Derby. They went on hunger strike. They did all sorts of things. They were fantastically courageous. It was a huge mass movement. They had demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people. It was a commitment that many, many people felt across all classes of women, and yet the Liberal government was completely intransigent to this question. It would not allow women even the most basic democratic right. But of course, it was also a government which wasn't allowing all sorts of other rights. There was really, by 1914, there was what is often called a sort of triple crisis in British society. There was the question of women's suffrage, and this had become more militant, although it had become slightly less of a mass movement in the sense that there was less mass participation in demonstrations. But in 1913, Herbert Asquith, who was the Prime Minister, introduced a suffrage bill, which again, and to the women's absolute fury, didn't include anything about women getting the vote. So this was a huge crisis which erupted again in 1912, 1913 over the question of women's suffrage. There was also two other crises. One was the crisis of Ireland, that the Irish very, very strongly wanted home rule, and this was a big movement, a mass movement of the Irish people, supported by some in the Liberal Party, and there was some move towards home rule, but bitterly opposed by the Tories and by the Unionists in the north of Ireland. Now, this obviously is beyond the scope of this story, but this was a crisis right up to the end of July 1914. In other words, the week before war was declared against Germany, everyone, including the cabinet, including the Prime Minister, thought that if there was a war, it would be a war in Ireland over the question of home rule for Ireland. So it was a very, very big and important crisis. The third was a level of industrial unrest, of strikes, of protests about pay, about workers' conditions, which had gone on since 1910. There have been these very, very big things. So by 1914, you had all these things. You had huge strikes breaking out, you had this crisis over Ireland, and you had the women fighting to get the vote. The interesting thing about this, obviously the fight for women to get the vote was supported by a whole number of men, like many of the left-wing men, people like Keir Hardie, who was a prominent Labour figure, I suppose a kind of Tony Benn of his day, that kind of thing. It was very, very strongly in support of women getting the vote, but it obviously was a movement of women mainly. You know, it was an issue which mainly women took up. But even when you look at the other ones, women were involved in them in a way that you perhaps wouldn't think of if you read the official histories. There were very big strikes of women in 1911, particularly in London. There was a kind of general strike of women in South London where they had sort of flying pickets that came and called out different groups of workers from different factories. And of course in Ireland, many of the people who supported Home Rule and went on to support independence for Ireland, and that became a big issue during the war itself with the uprising in 1916, were women as well. The most famous is a woman called Constance Markowitz, Countess Markowitz she was. She married a Polish aristocrat, fantastically brave woman who fought in the middle of Dublin in 1916 and was very important to it, and who also supported the workers' campaigns and the struggle of women for the vote. So these were things which were all coming together, and in all of them, women were very, very important to it. So I suppose you can see it, and this must be kind of one of the first times in modern history where women played such a big role. There was really, I mean, it's referred to now as first wave feminism in the way that academics talk about these things, first wave and second wave, which was the 60s and 70s, and then third wave, which is the more modern generation. But this first wave feminism, as it's now called, was an incredibly important political development, which started really in the kind of 1880s and 90s, but went right through, often called the new woman, women who were rejecting ideas of conventional women's roles, and sometimes rejecting relationships with men, sometimes rejecting marriage and all these kind of things, which was quite a difficult thing to do in the years before the First World War, and probably was mostly something done by women who were relatively privileged and comfortably off and so on. It's much harder for working class women to do these kind of things, but was very, very important in this respect, and it did lead to a sense that women could do all sorts of things. And if you read some of the novels, even novels written by men like George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells at the time, they show these women, and of course the plays of Henrik Ibsen, who, okay, was Norwegian, but the same, it was an international phenomenon, these women, that they show these strong women standing up for themselves, rejecting the old kind of family values and all these sorts of things. And so this is the background, really, to what happens with the vote for the suffrage. Now, the war, which was declared on the 4th of August 1914, as I'm sure you're all aware, put all of this into abeyance. That it stopped the whole Home Rule movement over Ireland. It stopped the industrial unrest that actually very, very quickly, not all of the labour movement by any means, but large sections of the Labour Party and the trade unions supported the war from very early on. I'll come on to important exceptions to it. And with the women, all the women's organisations, all the suffrage organisations split between people who supported the war and people who opposed the war. This was true of the what were called the suffragettes. This is a name which was initially a kind of derogatory name for them, you know, sort of ets being sort of, you know, young, stupid and airheaded, presumably was a kind of general sort of inference with it. But they were, of course, their real name was the Women's Social and Political Union. There was another organisation, the other main organisation was the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies, which actually was stronger in the north of England. It was quite strong in the textile districts of Lancashire. And it was probably a more working class organisation, actually. It was more closely tied to some of the trade unions and so on. And it had a more kind of constitutional approach to getting the vote. It didn't go in for the, you know, the publicity and the stunts and all the other things which the suffragettes were so effective at doing. So it's much less well known. It was run by a woman called Millicent Garrett Fawcett, who people probably have heard of the Fawcett Society, which is named after her, who was a very wealthy Liberal Party supporter, and who definitely didn't want to do anything illegal. Now, Millicent Garrett Fawcett supported the war from the very beginning, although many of the younger women in the NUP WSS didn't, particularly younger. I'm probably there were some older ones as well, but it was something of a split along those lines. The Pankhursts, of course, very famously split. The Pankhurst family, who were the founders of the WSPU, Emmeline Pankhurst, who came from a very left-wing background. She and her husband Richard were members of the Independent Labour Party in Manchester, and she eventually moved to London after his death. But she moved more and more, before the war even, she was moving more away from left politics, if you like, and she became a keen supporter of the war, as did her daughter Christabel, who was the eldest daughter, and was a very, very militant pro-war. Both of them became intensely patriotic, very, very pro-war. Emmeline Pankhurst launched a campaign in 1915, which was the right to serve. She wanted women to be able to go and join the army, which she regarded as a great, you know, that they could suffer equally with the men in terms of dying in the trenches and so on. And she and Christabel were very instrumental in the practice, which became widespread, of giving men in civilian clothes white feathers for cowardice, you know, which, I mean, is pretty abhorrent in its own right, but was even more abhorrent because many of the people they gave them to were, of course, men who had been in the army and for whatever reason, either because they were injured or mentally ill as a result of it, or maybe were just on leave, were given these as a sign of cowardice. But that was the way they approached it. Their younger daughter, or one of the younger daughters, Sylvia Pankhurst, who was very, very close to Keir Hardie before the war. And she was a very fine artist, and she was a very, very impressive woman in lots of ways. She, again, the split came just before the war, and it came over her support for the Irish, not the Home Rule question, but over the Irish, who had a big industrial dispute in Dublin. There was a big lockout, and she spoke at a huge meeting in London in their support, and this led to a breach between her and her mother and sister, who didn't like this connection with trade unions and with working class struggle and so on. They thought it discredited the suffragette movement and it should be kept completely separate from it. There was already this thing, and she set up her own little suffragette movement in East London, the East London Federation of Suffragettes. She worked and lived in East London. She was very committed to the people of the East End. She understood that the dockers, nearly all the dockers, who were one of the largest components of East End workforce at the time, and of course were men, most of them didn't have the vote either. And so she saw this as an issue, not just for women, obviously every woman should have the vote, but that also all men should have the vote as well. So she was very committed to this. And she opposed the war, she demonstrated. She wasn't the only one. There was a huge demonstration. Well, there were many, many demonstrations. You may have heard about this in other sessions. I know people have done other sessions, but there were huge demonstrations on the 2nd of August 1914, including one in London, and actually on the platform. Well, they had several platforms in those days, so you didn't have these things, and so people couldn't hear if it was a very big crowd. And it was a huge crowd. They said it was much bigger, according to the Manchester Guardian, than the biggest of the suffragette demonstrations. Now, whether that's true or not, it's hard to, I mean, that's one person's impression, but that is a big demonstration if it's true. And they had one platform, which was women, which included a woman called Charlotte Despard, who was very fine socialist and suffragette, although she'd fallen out with the Pankhurst some years earlier, as many, many people did, actually. And she was also, funnily enough, the sister of a man called Sir John French, who, if you read Adam Hochschild's book on the First World War, he writes about all this, which must have been fairly amazing. You know, he was running the British Army in the First World War, and she was campaigning against the war, and probably made family relations rather difficult. But on that platform, there was her, Charlotte Despard. There was also a woman called Mary MacArthur, who was a Women's Trade Union League leader, very important in the strikes that had taken place. Margaret Bonfield, who was from the Labour movement. So you had all that going on. And Sylvia was part of all this. She was also, she did loads and loads of very, very practical things in the East End. Of course, you have to remember that We always hear about the war now just in terms of the military. I mean, perhaps we'll talk in the final session about the poppies and all the whole hype behind the, you know, the red poppy and the military sacrifice. And of course, it is absolutely true that we should remember the military sacrifice, but much of this sacrifice was also on the home front, that rents went shooting up, food prices went shooting up, women's unemployment went up because many of the factories where they worked that weren't geared for war production shut down and they didn't have work. Their husbands would go off, you know, get signed up to go off and fight in the army, and they wouldn't get either any money for a time, or they wouldn't get adequate money to pay their rent and look after their kids and so on. So Sylvia Pankhurst did a load of things, including she did some she set up by the end of August 1914, because she was obviously a very sort of dynamic and well-organised woman. Before then, we had opened our cost-price restaurants where tuppenny meals to adults and penny meals to children were served to all comers with free meal tickets for the destitute. The Gunmaker's Arms, the disused public house, good name, we turned into a clinic, day nursery and Montessori school. So she did all that kind of work, which is, you know, basically relief work for the poor. I mean, it's, you know, and very, very much needed in a way that perhaps we might think is the case even today, but as a result of the impact of the war. But she also continued campaigning. There were other people who did things like this. For example, there were many women from the Independent Labour Party, which had a lot of very talented women in it. I don't know exactly why, what the reason for that was, but there was a very large number of women in it. It was very committed to feminist ideas, which may be one reason why it did attract women. But it also had women who were agitators and campaigners. And in Scotland in 1915, there was a very big rent strike in Glasgow, led by the women because of profiteering and rent rises, because there was a shortage of housing. So many workers were coming to work in Glasgow in the factories that turned out munitions. And it was led by a woman called Mary Barber, and there was also a woman called Helen Crawford who was involved. Both of those were ILP women, and you know, so they were socialists and suffragettes, and they were people who did all those sorts of things. There were also many attempts, nearly all by women, to set up peace campaigns. In fact, Sheila Rowbottom said about this, you know, Sheila Rowbottom, the historian, she said that it was from the feminists that the early anti-war organisations really developed in Britain, and I think there's a lot of truth in this. In 1915, there was a conference in The Hague, organised by an American woman, actually, and America, of course, was still outside the war, so it wasn't so contentious for an American woman to do it, but it was very contentious for British women to go. In fact, the government stopped them from going. The government took passports away. It even cancelled a boat that was going to The Hague that could have taken them, so they weren't able to go. Even though, to be honest, this conference was fantastically moderate in its aims and was very much, you know, we're going to send flowers to all the wounded soldiers from all the different countries. It didn't at all take a fantastically militant line on the thing, but even that was much too much for the British government. And it was out of the movement in 1915 and that conference that organisation, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which still exists, was formed. So you can see there's all these different kind of things going on. And at first, people found this an incredibly difficult thing to do. There was all the hardship of the war. There was the level of jingoism. I mean, although you have these huge demonstrations, really, within a month or two, it was very hard for people to demonstrate. We know that people who did demonstrate and protest, and particularly the conscientious objectors who refused to go and fight, were treated very, very badly in many cases and put in prison, and some of them threatened with going to the front and against their wishes and all this kind of thing. So it was very difficult to do. And there was a lot of repression. There was a woman called Alice Wheeldon, who, I don't know if people have heard of her, who lived in Derby, who essentially was fitted up by the Secret Services, really. She was an ILP member and the left wing, and she was very much against the war. But essentially, they concocted this plot, or the person who informed on her was somebody who provided the means for her carrying out this plot, which supposedly was that she was going to poison Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, who by then was the Prime Minister. And, I mean, if you look at it now, it looks absolutely ludicrous. But she and her family were put in prison and died prematurely, or some of them died prematurely as a result of that. So there's all that repression. But also, of course, there's another thing that was happening, which was the longer the war went on, the more people felt that this was a war which wasn't justified. By 1916, they had to introduce conscription, which, of course, was just for men. It was extremely unpopular, and people like Sylvia Pankhurst were involved in campaigns about that. The attitudes that women were developing were also changing. Women were, of course, doing jobs that they'd never done before. Now, you might not think, you know, you might think now a woman driving a bus or working in a bank is kind of not very remarkable. But in 1914, women didn't work in either of those industries, nor in many other industries as well. They went to work in all those. They also went to work in the big munitions factories, which were huge factories, very dangerous places to work, and there were explosions and people got killed. And you have descriptions of these women where they have to take off all their anything, metal buttons, which is what people used to wear, and brooches or anything like that, because if not, you could suddenly blow everybody up. So they worked in these conditions. It was a very big change for women. Before the First World War, the biggest single employer of women outside of the home was domestic service, was servants, which was pretty restrictive in all sorts of ways, both in terms of pay and social conditions. So working in these factories, whatever the downside, also created a new set of opportunities for women. And surprise, surprise, they started doing the most outrageous things, like having sex outside marriage and going to pubs and wearing shorter skirts and all this sort of thing, which was obviously absolutely dreadful. And they were, there was all sorts of moral scares about them and about prostitutes as well, who were treated abominably in the First World War. I mean, really, really dreadfully. You know, there was there was all sorts of repression. Actually, it was when the British government introduced licensing laws in pubs to stop people going and getting drunk, particularly munitions workers. But they also had all these laws stopping women from hanging around, as they saw it, hanging around near barracks and pubs and so on. And they could be put in prison and subject to terrible invasive examinations and all sorts of things. So you get a change coming on by about 1916, and certainly by 1917, where people are... there's a layer of women who are saying, well, you know, we don't like this war, we don't like the way we've been treated, we're not going to go back to the old way of doing things. And they begin to change their attitude in those sorts of ways. And it's then, I suppose, that two things, for the purpose of this talk, which are relevant, happen in 1917. The first is, in February 1917, there's a revolution in Russia which gets rid of the Tsar, which is extremely popular around the world. So you can begin to see that people are getting a bit fed up with all this, you know, war, the aristocracy, the old order, and so on. And this first revolution, the February Revolution, was led by women. It was on International Women's Day in the Russian calendar, which was in February. And they were fed up with bread shortages, because in Germany and Russia and places like that, people were starving. They were very, very, you know, blockades of food, and there were shortages of food and all sorts of things which were going on. So they... that was one thing happened, and it was very, very popular, and there was a conference in the summer of 1917 in Leeds, actually, in support of the Russian Revolution, which was very, very widely attended. But the other thing that happened, perhaps by coincidence, in the way that these things sometimes do, in June 1917, they eventually introduced a bill into the House of Commons for universal suffrage for men over 21, and a bill for women's suffrage, of course, not just for all women over the age of 21. You had to be 30, because obviously any woman under 30 was regarded as too, you know, I don't know, feckless and immature to be able to cast a vote. And you also had to have property qualifications. So it wasn't the victory that people wanted, but nonetheless, it was a recognition that that women would have the vote. And eventually, that became law in 1918, and eventually women got the vote on the same basis as men, pretty much, in 1928. So it took another 10 years after that. So why did they do it? Well, I put it down to really two reasons. I think, firstly, and they always said, oh, it's because the women have played such a great patriarchal role and worked so hard and all this kind of thing. But I think you have to reject that, because they never normally give you things for doing something like working hard. So I don't see why we should think that was necessarily the reason. I think two things. I think they understood the level of social unrest which was growing and the change in attitudes, and particularly things like the Russian Revolution absolutely terrified them for perhaps understandable reasons from their point of view. I think the second thing was they understood that the men dying in the trenches, many of them still didn't have the vote, and they understood that if they were going to extend the franchise to men, it was virtually politically impossible in these conditions where women were doing men's work and all sorts of things as well, not to give it to women as well. So they did so, but as I say, at that limited level. Final point, just before I conclude, is that the first woman elected as an MP was our friend Countess Markowitz in Ireland. She stood for the Sinn Féin Party, which was the Independence Party, and they won nearly all the seats in Ireland in 1918, but of course they refused to take their seats because they now had decided they didn't just want home rule, they wanted independence. So she never took her seat. The first woman who actually sat as an MP in Westminster was Lady Astor, who was a Tory. And one of the ironic things is all the women who campaigned for the vote, none of them actually became MPs, partly because some of them, like Sylvia Pankhurst, by this stage was so fed up with the whole thing, she'd become completely against standing for Parliament, and she became part of the Communist Party briefly, and then took up all sorts of other causes in the years after. So it's one of the ironies of it. And of course, the war was a terrible tragedy for men and women. I mean, there were a million surplus women at the end of the First World War who didn't, by and large, didn't get married, didn't have husbands or partners, because so nearly a million men had been killed. Of course, far more men were injured, many of them mentally injured, so it wasn't obvious to people, but women obviously bore the brunt of them coming home and the sort of terrible conditions in which they lived. It also, however, did open up opportunities for women, which I'm sure many of them, they wouldn't go back to domestic service after that. The first equal pay strike was in 1918, which was women on the London buses campaigning to get the same rate of pay as men, and we're still having a job to get that even now, but you know, hey, another 100 years maybe we might have got it. So it did open up all those opportunities. So I think we have to see it as something which was a terrible tragedy, but out of it, out of that disaster of the First World War, as we've seen in other, and I'm sure we've discussed in other sessions, it did create the impetus for change and the impetus for women changing. And in that sense, it was something which was, you know, a great, important event in terms of a landmark in terms of changing women's lives.